So I'm looking around at my defense, and guys are like, "You got this." And there's a it gets loud, standing ovation, like just starts. I'm like, at first, I'm like, "Dang, they had just announced my name," and I'm like, "Even these people know I'm having a great." Like it was almost kind of like they're cheering for me at Cleveland. I'm like, I turn around, and Jim Tomey's in the box.
Welcome into another episode of Baseball America's From Phenom to the Farm. I'm your host, Kyle Bandujo. On today's episode, I'm talking to a three-time World Series champion and former Giants left-hander Jeremy Affeld. If you think of Jeremy, you probably think of that run he had to end his career with the Giants. Dominant postseason left-hander on those three title teams really rode out into the sunset baseball-wise. As we dive into today, it was a long journey to get there. We go from his days at a tiny Washington State high school to his time in the Royal system and with the big club. Jeremy spent his first 10 years or so in pro ball trying to figure out who he was as a pitcher and figure out what his role should actually be. During his time in Kansas City, he shuttled between the rotation, the bullpen, even closing for a time, which really burned him out on baseball. We talk about his multiple rebirths and finding the right role in the back half of his career. We obviously have some postseason baseball talk and even some craft beer talk. Jeremy recorded the interview from the podcast studio in his brewery in Burney, Texas, Free Run Brewing, which I highly recommend to anyone who ever visits Burney, Texas. But it was a thrill to have Jeremy on. Great to chop it up. Great to talk some World Series baseball and great to get some of that technical pitching talk I love to have on the show. Episodes of Phenom on the Farm drop every other Tuesday. If you enjoy this one, subscribe wherever you get your podcast and go check out past interviews. And if you haven't yet, leave a 5-star rating and a review on Apple Podcasts. Also, make sure to subscribe to BaseballAmerica.com and the BA Podcast feed for all amateur baseball and prospect news. Scouting on international signings has been released. We've got some early college baseball coverage. Always a good time to be subscribed to Baseball America. And with that, let's talk to Jeremy Affeld. Joining in for today's episode from Phenom to the Farm, he's a third-round pick of the Royals in the 1997 draft. He's a three-time World Series champion with the Giants, lefty Jeremy Affeld. Jeremy, thank you so much for joining from Phenom to the Farm.
Heck yeah, man. I'm glad to be on here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's great to have it's not often I have a fellow Burney resident on the show, so excited to do this. I encourage anyone in Burney, Texas, or in the San Antonio surrounding area, go check out Free Run Brewery, where Jeremy is recording from right now. But Jeremy, I'll go back to pre-Free Run, pre-Big Leagues, a lot of things. When did you first realize you had a shot at the next level of baseball, whether that be professional baseball or the college level?
You know, my junior year in high school. So I played at a small school. Northwest Christian was 500 kids K-12. So it wasn't 500 in high school. It was the whole gamut, right? I went to a small private school. So we were in a pretty low level area of baseball where we would play. I mean, we play Indian reservations up there. We would play small towns. I mean, there'd be eighth graders on these high school teams because they don't have enough, right? They're trying to fund it. So to me, it was a hard thing for some of these guys to even think about, is he really that good? I may give him one hit my senior year. It was like a homer. It was one hit.
Like, I mean, I'm imagining an eighth grader kid on an Indian reservation facing a future big leaguer.
Yeah, like 90 like some miles an hour. You know, I was throwing 90 I was throwing 93 93 my senior year. So, I mean, it from the left side on top of it, right? So, yeah, so, you know, just trying to go out there and, man, to compete at that level, you're dominating people, right? So my summer, my junior year, I tried out for the Blue Devils, which was a Legion ball team, and it was a 3A Legion. So it was the highest level of Legion ball you can. And a lot of the upper high schoolers of all the bigger high schools in Spokane, that's where they played. And I remember getting invited to be on that team, and I kind of figured that would be my pulse, because it's like, now these are the guys that are facing, you know, high velocity. They've had to make teams. There's tryouts for their teams, probably, where Northwest was like, you want to play, right? And we had a good team. We were 16. I think we were undefeated 4 years in a row, and I had four of my guys on my team all made the same Blue Devil team. So we had a good team, but we would beat teams 32-0. In five innings, we'd 10 run them. Like it was, and my coach was actually Jack Hancock, a mentor of mine. He would pull me out for three innings. I wouldn't pitch. He wouldn't even try to, I mean, he wasn't trying to run up the score. It was just, that's how bad some of those scenarios were, right? So getting into the Blue Devils my summer year, between my junior and senior year, I remember I remember all of a sudden scouts are coming to watch another guy, John Barneson, who actually played at Northwest Christian. He was a shortstop for us and transferred to a place called Meade High School. And he's unbelievable talent, super smart guy, scored perfect on his SATs, genius, Stanford guy. I mean, super smart, but a man among boys. Like, he was a man, shaved when he's a sophomore, you know, just like crazy, right? Strong,
yeah, I know the
good
type,
player.
Yeah.
Yeah, athletic, you know, all that stuff, right? So, you know, he went and there's some scouts, college and professional scouts, that were looking at him in our Legion ball. And I just happened to be pitching that day. And I pitched and threw really well. And I remember scout coming up to me and being like, "Hey, man, where do you go to school?" And I said, "Northwest Christian." And he's like, "Northwest Christian? I never even heard of that." And I told him where I was at and how small it was. And he was like shaking his head, like, "How did we not see, like, we just all missed this. Like, you've been, how long, you know?" I'm like, "Yeah, I'm a junior and about to be a senior." And he's like, it was almost all the other scouts started walking up to me and kind of getting in a circle. And they all, and then by the next three or four games, man, scouts were all over the place. And then they started handing me these tests, you know, these psychological tests. Would you rather live in a cabin in the woods or in the city? You know, it's all the stuff they do to try to figure out who you are, right?
Cabin in the woods describes minor league baseball a little better.
Yeah, exactly. So, and is your favorite movie Bull Durham or what? Can you, you know, do you dream of being a part of that lifestyle? Stuff like that, you know? So, you know, and so I remember just filling that out and thinking, man, I might have, I don't know anything about pro, but college, yeah. And I was doing well. And the next thing I know, my senior year, by the end of that summer, the Gonzaga coach came out and he was watching, who's a friend of mine to this day, the Hertz family. Both of him and his nephew his nephew played on the Gonzaga team that I would have played on. So they're good friends of mine today. And they came out, watched, and he was like, "We're going to keep watching you." And then he was at practices before the game started. I'm like, "Wow, why is there a coach at a practice?" I mean, it just was foreign to me. And my high school coach wouldn't tell me about it. He was a really good guy, man. He's like, "No, we're not playing that game. You just go be who you are." You know, he did a really good job of handling the scouts and the college scouts. He really did. And
so you're getting all this attention, but you're not going, like, Gonzaga's local. Did you have any thoughts of, like, hey, what is Washington and Washington State up to, or you're kind of still, like, in this bubble, just there.
I was,
to you,
because no one could trust it. No one could trust it. Those numbers are like, they're video game numbers. They're not even, like, they don't make sense. I mean, I'm hitting 470 as a hitter, you know, like in high school, you're hitting 470 or 500 and and you got, like, you've given up two hits. Like, there's no way. That's just mind boggling. Like, if I'm a scout, I'm like, I can't even gauge that. But my velocity alone should have given him something, right? You're left-handed throwing 90 miles an hour. I'm pretty sure we'll make it work.
In 1997, too, which is a different level of elo.
Yeah. like, come on, man. Yeah, it's not like, it, you know, it's now you see these guys throwing 100 in high school. But back then it was like, come on, man. There's not even a lefty in the big leagues that throws that hard. There's not 12 of them or 15 of them back then, right? There's a few of them, Randy Johnson and stuff like that. But so WSU coach actually said I was overrated. He actually said that. He said, "Nah, it's overrated." I'm like, "Oh, wow." And then Lewis and Clark was interested, and they're a great baseball school, obviously.
Legendary NAIA program.
Yep. Legendary. And they, but then I found out you had to box for your position. And at that time, I'm 170 pounds. I'm like, "I'm not going there. I'm going to get my butt kicked, man."
Lewis and Clark State is like like guys on, like, when I was in college, it was one of the things that you tell, like, tall tales about what you've heard about what guys at Lewis and Clark State have to go to.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I played with a guy that went there. He's like, "No, we boxed. We did." I'm like, "Oh my gosh, that's real." Like, it was just so foreign. But then I couldn't get, you know, Oregon, before they have a decent program, but at that time they didn't. They offered me a full ride without even seeing me. I'm like, "Well, that's weird. I don't know if I want to do that. You haven't even seen me, you know?" And so I remember flying down to, but I was that kid that I was like, then I was starting to believe it, right? Like, "Oh, I can do this. I can do this." I had scouts at every practice. I had 30 scouts at a game. Like, it was nuts, right? Like, people. And then I had one scout, Greg Smith, for the Royals, that followed me everywhere. He would show up in the littlest town in Timbuktu, and he would be there. He was the only scout that was at every single game. And they eventually drafted me, right? The Royals draft, but he was there. He was like, no, I sniffed this thing like along. Like, this is, he was falling. He had just got out of the big leagues. He was a backup second baseman to the Cubs. He was a backup to Sandberg, but then he was a backup to in with the LA Dodgers as well. And so he had just got out of the game. So he was kind of seeing high velocity left-handed, pretty tough, right? So he was a great guy for me, still a friend of mine. And he, I remember he just kind of, he said, what do you want to do? You want to go play professional baseball or college? And I'm like, I don't know. Like, in my head, why wouldn't you want to play professional baseball? Like, that's a dream, man. And my mom was like a teacher. They're both teachers. My mom, she's a teacher. My dad was retired military. Now he's a teacher. But she was like, he should go to college. And my dad was like, he was great. He was like, no, you're going to let him do whatever he needs to do. Like, if he's going to go play professional baseball, college will be there. It's not going anywhere. And he can go back. But this is a career choice. Like, let him. And my dad joined the military when he was 18 and still got a master's degree. So he kind of had that understanding of being able to chase something. And my mom came around to that. And I remember getting drafted. I remember going to Letourneau University down here in Texas, and the coach looking at me and saying, "Hey, man," he didn't believe it until I tried out for him, hit, pitch, everything. And he was like, "Hold." Crap, like, all right, like, I'll give you a full ride, but I can't give it to you via athletics because he's a NAIA, or he was a Division II. I can't remember what they were at the time. He said, but I can't give you a sports scholarship. I have to give you an academic. And I have a high 3.9, so I had a high enough grade point average. And he said, I'll give it to you that way. He's like, and you're good enough to play here, probably D1 schools, definitely, but you're not good enough to play professional baseball. And I remember when he said that, I kind of shook his hand. I said, appreciate that. Thank you, and walked out. And my mom was excited, and she's like, I'll fill out your paperwork for you. Like, this is awesome. You know, you got Gonzaga, you got NA." And they were excited because my sister was at George Fox, and it was costing them a mint to send her to college. So they were like, we don't pay for college. This is great, right? And I remember looking at my mother, and I was like, I'm not playing for that man. She's like, what? Why? I was like, because he flat out looked me in the eye and said he didn't believe in me. Like, he literally said that I'm not good enough. Like, I'll never play for a guy like that. And I appreciate honesty, but you don't know. You can't say I'm not good enough. Like, I just blew away three of your top hitters on nine pitches. Like, I'm good enough. There's got to be something. Maybe I'm not good enough. Maybe I am, but you telling me that is probably not something that I'm going to be able to want to receive from a guy that I don't trust yet, you know? And so I just said, I'm not playing for him. I gotta play for people that believe in me. And the Gonzaga coach was definitely believing in me. He was like, I'll give you a full ride for 4 years because I think you're that good, and I think you can go everywhere else too. And so that gave me hope. But then when they drafted me in the third round, the Royals did, and I was like, I'm going. Like, third round, it's not like I got drafted in the 10th round or 33rd round. And my parents didn't really understand it at the time. I mean, it's tough. Think about it. You're getting drafted in the third round. Your son's getting drafted at, I'm 17 years old. All of a sudden, this pro team where my dad was like, we were just watching baseball on TV. We didn't think you'd be in the third round with one of these
Well,
guys.
it's not like it is now where there's the top 500 rankings. You can see the slot for every pick and things like that. I mean,
That's right.
draft day in general had to be, I mean, they're doing that over a conference call.
Yeah, you just don't even know. Yeah, there's no you negotiate your contract. Like, that's what you do. You negotiate. I had to get an agent, and they were hoping I wouldn't get one because they're like, we can probably try to sneak something in. I got an agent. He got an okay deal for me, but I remember the only reason I fired him was I was talking to him later that summer, and he looked at me and said, "Man, I could have got you more money." And I'm like, why didn't you? He's like, well, you said you wanted to play. You just wanted to get down there. Well, but you could have negotiated. You could have negotiated? He's like, yeah. He said, but you just wanted to go. And I'm like, I'm pretty sure agents are supposed to look out for your best interest, you know? And so I fired him, and my mom found a guy named Mike Moy in Sports Spectrum. And I called him, and he's my agent for the rest of my career. And I mean, he's amazing. I mean, he's Erkman, Beckett. I mean, he's the agent for Todd Helton. I mean, he's got a he's a big, big agent. Josh Hamilton, and great man, good friend of mine. And I hired him, and he just encouraged me the whole time. He's like, you've got it. You just got to keep your head on your shoulders and learn as much as possible, you know? And so even in the minor leagues, I wouldn't say I knew I'd be a big leaguer. I think it was my double A year that I knew it, but I had people, I ended up surrounding myself with people that were just pushing me and telling me, you know, grind it out. It's going to be tough and get through it. And it, I appreciated that whole process of every coach, every mentor, every agent that pushed me along the way. I was very thankful.
What was the culture shock like when you got into pro ball? Because you go from winning games 38-0 to now you're up against guys with similar talent. You're up against other first round picks and things like that. And you know, with limited opportunities to test yourself in high school, what were those like the first 2 years like when you're out of the house for the first time, you're just learning how to be an adult, learning how to be a professional, and up against competition that up to that time you had not seen?
Man, that's a great question because it's a fact. I got down there, I gave up 4 hits in my first outing. I thought I was a loser. I thought I was the worst pitcher ever. I was like, I just gave up 4 hits in 3 innings. Like, what's happening? I had no idea how to give up hits. I literally didn't. I gave up so few hits. I did not know what it felt like to even get it. And 4 hits. We're talking 4 hits. Like, big deal. I mean, but I'm dealing with, you know, 17-year-old kids from Dominican that have been swinging wood bats since they were 4. You know, like I didn't even understand that culture. I had no idea that the Latin guys that I'd be on the team with, that was foreign to me at first. I'm like, wow, this is interesting. But they were so good, like incredibly, and they're my age. I'm like, well, I've never even seen talent like this. I mean, they were so good athletically. It was crazy. And then some of the high school kids, obviously, that were in these big Texas schools, you know, like that my son's playing in now, that is just off the chart talent. And I just didn't even know that existed, you know, coming from where I came from. So
did you even have a sense of your craft, like how to pitch? Cause I'm assuming in high school, you didn't need much more than that fastball.
I didn't. I had a fork ball that I threw for fun. Cause it was funny watching guys swing at it. Cause it danced and stuff like that. I had a good curveball again that I threw for fun. It was just cause you made people look complete. So kids were ducking and I was it was a fun thing. I didn't need probably more than my fastball, but you know, I throw a curveball right at a guy and, you know, it's just funny. Now you throw a curveball at a guy and he just spits on it. And you're like, wait, what? Like he didn't even like act like that was even a curveball. And they're like, yeah, man, it didn't come out of your hand right. I'm like, come out of my hand right? What are you talking about? So you see all those things that I had to learn. I had no idea. And so I had to literally learn to pitch. I had a hard time playing catch. I mean, my catch partner, Taylor Myers, he was a friend of mine, still talk to him every now and then. And he would get so mad at me because I'd overthrow him. And he's like, dude, can you play catch? Like I just threw far, but I didn't know how to like hit the glove every time or hit the chest. It was never part of my deal. There was just so much that I had to learn and understand. Roommates. I literally had a roommate that didn't think like me, act like me, talk like me. Like
I'm sure it was a big really time nice culture shock too.
All the way around.
I'm sure it was just the
it was luxury. In a hotel room. We got put up in the hotel rooms. It was the Radisson Inn in Fort Myers, Florida, you know, and then they paid for our breakfast. Literally, that's what we were. We were in hotel rooms the whole
I'm
season.
Shocked that you got any free meals, especially in 97, 98.
Yeah.
It's funny in multiple looking back at like multiple BA scouting reports in the Royals top 30 at that time, your win totals are mentioned in both of them, like mentioning that you led a league in losses, your win, something that doesn't factor into pitching evaluation now.
Yeah.
And especially considering the minors are the priorities, development, not winning. But I'm curious at that time when pitcher wins were a big deal. Is that something that you took stock in or affected how you felt about yourself if you were picking up an L on the day in a high A game?
100%, because I didn't like to lose, and I took that. I was over analytical too, right? So I did. I led the league in, I think, 16 losses. I actually led the league. I think I might still have the record. I gave the most hits. I gave up 16 hits in like a 4 1/3 inning game. I mean, I gave up all kinds of hits. Like it was mind-boggling. And the crazy thing was, not only did I 16 losses, they protected me on the 40 man after that series, or after that year. And that just tells you that the powers that be, the guys that understand the game, don't care about wins and losses. They care about, where's his velocity average? Where's he sitting at? Not where's he hitting. I don't care if he throws 96. Where's he sitting? He's sitting at 92. Okay, so we're looking at 92. So 92, how's his breaking ball? Why, you know, he might have taken some losses, but could be everything. We got A-ball defense out there. You know, you got wild stuff. You got a catcher not knowing probably what to call. You got all kinds of stuff, right? But I should have known then, when they protected me, that they look at the game differently. And now that I see it, I know how they look at the game, and they don't care about your wins and losses in the minor leagues. What they care about is, can you hit the spot? Can you throw to the location? Can you, if you're a hard, if you're an, if you're a acceleration guy, if you're out there just letting it fly, can you hit the halves? Like, you throw 100, you don't need to hit it on the corner. I just need you to throw the outer half, not the inner half, or throw the inner half, not the outer half. Can you do that? Like, because they know when you get to the big leagues, they've got every scouting report known to man. They got a catcher that knows what he's doing. They've got everything going. So they just want to know, can you execute a certain pitch? They don't care if you get hit in double A because you threw a curveball on a, you know, on a 2-2 count when the guy was late on your fastball. You throw a curveball and hang it, and he hits it for a double at the gap. They don't care about that because they're not going to call that pitch up there. You know, they're not going to be on the same page. They just want, can you execute it? And so for me, I didn't see all that. So winning and losing was a big deal. I had a hard time. I think I wanted to quit a couple times just because I hated. And they don't tell you that, and I understand why they don't tell you that, because they want to push you. But if they would have given me a little bit more understanding, it probably would have given me a little more confidence. So I was in my own head a lot of times, and my fear of failure was higher. I didn't have a fear of success. I feared failure. And then so when you're throwing hard and you're throwing this curveball and you're still losing, you're like, you know, you just take deep breaths. And but if anything, it teaches you to lose. It teaches you to, like, get up the next day and try it again. It teaches you all that stuff, right? And then my double A year was really good. You know, I made three all-star teams then, and didn't get to the big leagues, and I was pissed off about that, right?
You said earlier that you knew when you got to double A, you knew you'd be a big leaguer. What was it, the club's confidence in you being added to the 40? Is that what told you, or was there something about you looking around and seeing at all these other pitchers in this league and how you stack up and saying, okay, I have, like, how do you know in your heart, okay, I have what it takes to make it to the big leagues?
Yeah, that's it. Double A was a level for me that, one, there were guys at that time, not as much now, but that time there were guys in Double A that were in the big leagues, have had big league time. They went up. You're facing them. Then you got all the rehab guys that you're facing. And I'm starting to face big leaguers now in a rehab, but not on like a Florida, like a Gulf Coast league, not on a rookie. I saw big leaguers come down to rehab, but you didn't really take much stock in that because they weren't even caring. The double A rehab is more like, no, I gotta be ready. I'm taking legit at bats here. I'm working counts because I got to go back up. And so you were at that level with them. And for me, when I was beating those guys, and then I was throwing my curveball for strikes, I had revamped my curveball in the instructional league the year before with Mike Mason and a pitching coach that I value, highly value, of getting me not to the big leagues, but sustaining my success there. You know, when Mike Mason broke me down and we got my curveball back on track, I was throwing it for strikes, and all of a sudden I'm just dominating hitters. And you're making a double A all-star team. When I made the Texas League all-star team, you're like, okay, definitely can go to triple A. You know, I can pitch up there. If they call me up, I was wanting to get called up to even triple A. I could get my feet wet up there, hopefully, and just see, now you got actual 4A players that are there, guys that should be playing in Japan. They got big league talent, but they can't sustain it. Go to Japan, or they're bouncing back and forth. So you're seeing big league talent up there. So I wanted to kind of try that. So I was trying to get there. But then when I made the all Texas, when I made the all double A all-star team of both leagues, that's when I knew. I was like, no, I know. And I started the Texas one, and then I came in pretty early on the all double A all-star game, and then I made the postseason all-star game. So when I made those, I knew I had the ability, and I had beat out guys that were called up to the big leagues. So it's like that guy got called to the big leagues, but my numbers are better. So you saw teams that were pulling guys up, right? And I was still pretty young though. I was a young kid. I was still 21 years old, right? So, for me, I kind of had that. Went to the fall league, did really well in the fall league. Had one, I
Which
think.
is usually like majority of the fall league is going to make it at some point. It's a showcase league.
That's right. It is
I
that.
don't want to get into the minutia of pitching too much, but you mentioned like getting the curveball on track and that's stuff that interests me. Is that because sometimes it's like guys can spin a ball or guys can't spin a ball, but when you're getting it back on track, is it a grip adjustment? Is it working with you on a confidence or a new arming or a new way to throw it, a new way you should be using it? Like, what is getting a pitch on track and turning it into a big league pitch or an effective pitch between, as opposed to just something that you can spin well but aren't using effectively?
Yeah, I think it was both. My spin rate on my curveball, I mean, I say that. That's just, I actually hate the analytics side of things right now, but that's what they call it. But my curveball was really good in A ball. It was really good. I just couldn't throw for a strike. So it would be nasty. But what hitters started to figure out is like, I'm just going to take it. I can't hit it. It breaks too much. It snaps. But so it would always be right in the dirt, right? And or umpires would miss it. It's a hard pitch for them to catch because at that time, I was literally 12 to 6. So an umpire would miss a lot because it would fall out of the sky. And so what we did was like, hey man, why don't we, I want to change. They changed my grip a little bit and they had me a little bit more around. So it would be 12 to 6, but it was more like 11 to 5. And then it was back off on your curveball. I want you to learn to flip the curveball in, strike one, and then throw your snapper. So I had to learn how to throw the strike, which means just flip it up there, man. Hitters are not going to swing at it right away. You start 0-0 and you throw a curveball, it starts up over their head. They're not going to try to hit that. Then once you get into a count, throw your one for a strike because they're swinging. And so I had to learn how to throw it, when to throw it, and command it. And I had to be able to go 2-1 to 2-2. So I had to learn how to get my curveball to where I could get back into a count. So learning when I'm 2-1, flipping it in there. Get me back to 2-2. That's what started separating me is I could throw a curveball for a strike behind the count. And that's where they kind of started speeding me up a little bit.
So you finish that Double-A season, you go to big league camp, spring training 2002. Walking into big league camp as a guy who had not yet tasted Triple-A or not done extended time in Triple-A, were you thinking, I'm going in with a chance to make this team?
I went in with so I was in big league camp the year before because I was on the 40 man, but I was on that first cut after 2 weeks, right? You just went up there for we'll do it, have some good time, and then go back and get ready. But
Yeah, first big league camp. Let's,
But
yeah,
what
that
it
thing.
did help me with is being comfortable around big leaguers. So the next year coming in, I know those guys, right? Comfortable with them. A lot of those guys came down to double A. And we hung out and just kind of, on the bench or out in the field. And so I was comfortable with being in that environment. And I learned a lot in the fall league, but I came in thinking, listen, like they got starters. They got five already. They got guys ahead of me, and guys that were in AAA have a chance. I'm probably going to go to AAA. But I'm going to give it everything I got. And if anything, what anything, I'm going to show them that I should be here. But my guess, I hadn't been AAA yet. So it's like, I'll probably have to go, but I'm going to try to, but I wanted to try to stay in big league camp as long as possible. One, the food is way better. So you're like, I don't want to go down because I don't want the minor league spring training slop, So I was like, I need to stay here. And I got a lot of wisdom. I got to hang with, and the more you hang with those guys, just the more confidence you have of like, I deserve it, right? Like I stayed long enough to where I competed and I'm gonna go to AAA thinking, yeah, but I'm pretty close. Like I'm a call away. Like I'm gonna pitch like it and believe it, And so that's what my whole goal was at the time.
And so you get into spring training 2002 and you start throwing up zero after zero after zero. You survive one cut, survive two cuts. When do things start getting a little like there's fewer people in this clubhouse right now?
Yeah, it started getting down there, and there was a guy, so we had Daryl May, that came over from Japan. He was going to start. He had signed a deal, so he was going to be one of the starters. And so I knew that that wasn't in me. And I had only started. I had only started in my minor league career, right? So that's all I did. But in that whole camp, I was relieving. I was just coming in whenever they asked me. They usually brought me in to start an inning so that I would be out of a windup, right? So they never did anything. So we had Daryl May was going to be. So I saw that writing was on the wall there. You had Dan Reicher, you had Jeff Suppan, you know, you had gonna figure out who. There's a couple other starters. I'm trying. Oh, you had Paul Bird. You know, you guys are like, I got no shot of being.
Grimsley was on that team, wasn't he?
Grimsley was on that team, yeah. And Roberto Hernandez, and they were good for me. I enjoyed them, but they were still at that high upper big league status, right? Where you're like, they didn't care about you. They're getting ready for a season, you know. And so we got thinner and thinner, and then it was basically when you see the lefties, really it was just me and Schaus, you know. And I'm like, all right. I don't know how many teams are going to take two lefties. Brian Schaus he ended up having a pretty good career, actually, but he was kind of a low-level guy, kind of a lower velocity, but he threw from, like, down under, right? And so he kind of had that weird, funky arm slot. He was having a great spring, and I was having a good spring. I ain't giving up a run, right? And so I was like, this is awesome. Then the articles were being written, and I played in Pittsburgh, and I remember I was in Pittsburgh. I was throwing 94 miles an hour in spring training, and striking out the side. I was dropping down. I was getting so confident, I would drop down and throw a sidearm curveball just to see if it worked. I was striking big, big time big leaguers out. I was like, this is awesome. You know, I'm like, my confidence is getting there, right? And I remember an article that came out, and I actually framed it. Someone framed it for me. It was pretty cool. And they were just talking about how Poznanski did it. Really good writer.
Joe Poznanski.
Phenomenal writer, right? Yeah. So he wrote it, and he said, man, just sitting out there bored is nothing. And this kid comes in throwing 94, and it was like everybody perked up, and you know, like the game got interesting all of a sudden. And I remember he basically was calling for me to be on the team. He's like, you got nothing. Like, you got to have this guy. You got to give us something to be excited about here in Kansas City, right? Like, that's what he said, basically. And I remember,
because that was the era of not much Kansas City excitement. Yeah. It was Mike Sweeney and not much else.
Yeah, like Sweeney Dog was an MVP, and you're like, oh, we got an MVP, you know, like that's about what you got working for you, you know. And so and I remember sitting there, and I just pitched, and I went on every road. They had me go on every road trip. I mean, they were breaking me in at the time. I didn't know it, but I'd be so tired in spring training. I wouldn't even pitch, I'd just go. And I'd be like, dude, I'd take score. They had me scorekeeping. Like, that's what I got. I had to drive 3-hour bus rides to scorekeep. While all my buddies were at home, they're going into town, they're having food, they're grilling out with their wives in the pool, and I'm out there slugging it on this baseball field, keeping score of the game, right? So I remember coming in, I was super tired, and I didn't have to I had pitched the day before. We got back super late, and we had to make another trip to play the Cleveland Indians. Just up the road, but still with traffic, it's like 45 minutes. And I remember just sitting, all of a sudden, they're like, Affelt, you're at the game today. And I'm like, what? I just pitched yesterday. They're like, you gonna say no? We just said you gotta go. And I'm like, kind of wanted to say no. You know, I was like, enough. You know, I'm like, this sucks. So I remember I got on the bus, and they're like, you're back up, so don't worry about it. You're only emergency if needed. I'm like, all right, so go to the game. I'm sitting there, and our we have this Rule 5 kid that has to make the team, so he starts, and he's giving it up. I mean, ball's going everywhere. So I'm just kind of sitting there, but I'm backup, right? I'm like, there's 9 pitchers that got to go before me. Like, there's no way. I don't care what the score is. So I'm just sitting there. I'm just kicked back, and I got my cleats on, but I'm not even taking score. They don't have me scorekeeping right now. I'm just sitting down there. And the phone rings, and he looks at my bullpen coach. I can't think who was at the time. I can't remember who was at the time. But he looked at me and said, hey, you're up. And I'm like, up where? He's like, you're up, like warm up. I'm like, what? So I jump up. I mean, I don't even know what planet I'm on right now. I am not ready. So I'm just firing balls, like trying to get energy, right? Like get loose. warming up, firing it. Now I'm, and I start to lock in. I really did. I did do that. I started to just get in that competitive, locked in, and they call me in the game. So he's like, "You're in." So I run into the game, and I'm warming up. I have no idea what's going on in the game. I have no idea. Like, I don't know who's on base. I don't know what this freaking score is. I'm just like not paying attention. So I come in and I get done warming up, and I turn around and I look around, and the bases are loaded. And I'm like, "Oh, bases are loaded." So I'm looking around at my defense, and guys are like, "You got this." And there's a it gets loud, standing ovation, like just starts. I'm like, at first, I'm like, "Dang, they had just announced my name." And I'm like, even these people know I'm having a great, like, it was almost kind of like they're cheering for me at Cleveland. I'm like, I turn around, Jim Tomey's in the box, and he's pointing his bat at me. Legend. You know, like Casey at the bat, like he's pointing at me, and I'm like, this is like my hero. Like, I love that guy. You know, like I watched him since I was a kid. Like he's in a box. I got bases loaded, and I'm like, okay, just don't act like nothing affects you. So I'm just nothing affects me. Like, no big deal. So I go up there, fire fastball, boom, strike one. And I'm like, he just takes it, and then he looks down at Maine, and Maine starts laughing. And I don't know what he's laughing at. He's just talking. And all of a sudden, he calls a curveball. Throw a curveball. Kind of buckles him a little bit. And strike two. And I'm like, okay, I'm 0-2 on Jim Tomey. Base is loaded. And so I'm like, all right, I'm going to throw I want to throw another. I'm going to throw another. I'll throw another curveball. And Maynard's went fastball away. And I'm like, fastball away. All right. Threw a fastball. But I was scared. I'm like, I'm not freaking giving up bomb to this guy who is homers off, you know, fastballs. And so I threw it way away. I mean, I threw it so far away, it was like sailed it. And I want a curveball. And he goes, nope, fastball away. And I'm like, all right, I'm going to throw this. Because I kind of started to figure out, I'm like, oh, it's because he's probably sitting curveball. Maynard knows it, that I just burnt a fastball after I buckled on a curveball. All right, I'm going to throw this. And he wanted it up a little bit, you know. So can I got to throw this belt high fastball to Jim Tomey. So, and
destroyer of belt high fastballs.
Yeah. You're like, this is not a good, but I'm like, all right, man. So I remember I fired a run and Jim never even moved. What? Strike three. And the umpire rung him up, which I didn't think he would, you know, but I threw it, boom, hit the glove, strike three. And Jim Tomey looked at me and I just kind of walked off. Cause that was the end of the inning. Right. And I walked off just like, no big deal. Just kind of walked off. But my heart was coming out of my freaking chest. I was like, holy crap, I just struck out Jim Tomey, bases loaded. You know, okay, don't show excitement. Believe you be here. Just sit down. So I sat down, and they looked over at me, and they said, yeah, you're done. I'm like, cool. Kind of, they can go to the shower up, do whatever. You don't have to keep score today. Just kind of something. All right. So I went and showered up, and I sat there, and I was just, like, freaking out in my brain. Well, about a week later, in the camp, I hadn't been told I'm going down yet. No, I'm just sitting there. Last day, Brian Schaus is crying, excited. I'm like, hey, man, you're all right. He's like, yeah, they just told me I made the team, man. This is awesome for my family. And I shook his hand, but in the back of my head, I'm like, oh, man, I'm getting sent down. I just threw 16 scoreless or whatever it was. Like, I'm getting sent down. So I pretty much didn't have a shot. Like, it didn't matter what I did. And so I'm sitting there, and I'm not even focused during the drills. I'm messing up. I'm not even joining in. I'm just kind of pissed off. And because everybody had been told the team, like, it's it. And I'm just, like, sitting there, and we have a game that day. So I'm at home, and I'm, like, sitting there, and all of a sudden, right before the game starts, they're like, hey, Jeremy, Skip needs to see you. So I'm like, all right, here's Jeremy, great job, blah, 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 blah. We just don't have a spot. Go down AAA, dominate, we'll call you up. Okay, so I'm sitting there, and I remember just sitting there and the pitch, I think it was Nipper. Was it Nipper? I think it was Nipper. Nipper walked in, looked at me, and just kind of did, gave me a little shrug of like, sorry, kid, you know? Like, and I'm sitting there, I just kind of shook my head. And I just remember Skipper looked at me and said, hey, man, what's the biggest stadium you've pitched in? And I'm like, I don't know, Round Rock. He's like, well, they're bigger in AAA. All of them are like that in AAA. I'm like, yeah. He's like, "You think you're ready for that?" And I'm like, "Yeah, I'm good." He's like, "Well, you better be ready for that because you're on my team." And I was like, "What?" I mean, I remember like just like, "Oh," I just sat there, and I was like, "What'd you say?" He's like, "You're on my team, man. So I need you to be ready for triple deckers, 50,000 people yelling at you. I need you to do what you did this spring. But you're on my team. You're going with us." And I was like, he's like, "So I hope you have a suit." I said, "I don't have a suit." He's like, $500 fine if you don't get on the plane with a suit." I'm like, so I'm like, my brain's spinning. I'm like, holy crap. So I remember my ex-wife, yeah, I remember texting my ex-wife, like, I was like, "I gotta get a suit. Like, I don't know what to do. Like, I just, you know, I'm thinking," or I wasn't texting because I was just like thinking in my head. I'm like, "I gotta call my wife. I gotta tell her I get a suit. She's not there. I gotta pack." Like, I was not ready.
Gotta find the Fort Myers men's warehouse.
Yeah, like I literally had nothing, man. And I remember I was just like, "Who?" So I remember walking outside with my Nokia cell phone or whatever I had, and I called, and I was surprised. The first person I called, my dad, and my dad answered, and he's like, "Hey, man, what's up?" I'm like, "Dad," I was like, "I made the team." And all of a sudden it was silent. And I'm like, "Dad," he's like, I remember he just started crying. And he was like, "Jeremy, you made the team?" I'm like, "Yeah, I'm going to the big leagues, Dad." He was just weeping. And he's a military guy. They don't cry for nothing, right? So I haven't heard him cry very much. And I just remember he's like, "Jeremy, I'm so proud of you," screaming. I called my wife at the time. I called her. She was preparing to drive down to Omaha with our stuff. She wasn't even thinking big leagues. So she didn't even know how to like say congratulations. She's like, "Oh, cool." I'm like, "Cool. This is the," and she just couldn't wrap her mind around it, you know? And I just remember that feeling of just like, you literally cannot, you have to actually live through it. I feel like there's a difference of you getting called up to the big leagues. And that would be an amazing thing too, in the middle of a triple A season or double A season. But to sit there and be like getting called in by your big league manager, telling him you made the team, leaving with the team, walking onto a private jet, walking onto the team plane, being like, "What the? This is like movie stuff." And the food, like the cookies, like I'm like, "What is happening? You get catered meal." Like it was just the
That's
craziest
what
thing.
everyone says about the big leagues, man. It's the cookies.
Yeah,
That's why
dude,
everyone loves
they're
playing in the
great,
big
man.
leagues.
Oh man, like just crushing those unbelievable cookies, man. I mean, just walking into the big league clubhouse in Kansas City when we arrived there and just looking around. Our uniforms are perfect, lockers are massive. I mean, it was unbelievable.
Without the ones like you who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Label.
I mean, it's 30 days in spring training that changed the course of your career. It starts your service time earlier.
That's right.
Change probably you're probably you probably get to free agency a year earlier because you had that spring training.
That's right.
With that, from 2002 to 04, those first few seasons in Kansas City, they feature you shuttling from the rotation to the bullpen. You've been a starter in the minor leagues. That's two very different jobs in terms of what you have to accomplish. In the bullpen, you could let it all hang out for an inning. Starter, you got to do things a little differently. The routine is different. I mean, how challenging is that trying to find a role while every time out you're trying to get big league hitters out?
Yeah, I mean it was terrible. Like honestly, it was so hard mentally. Because they didn't really know. I started out as a reliever, dominated that first half. I mean, I just came in, did exactly what I did spring training. First guy I faced, Kenny Lofton, one of my childhood heroes, just watching with
Goat,
Cleveland, struck
man.
him out, you know?
Put that man in the
Like,
Hall of Fame.
yeah. I mean, he was unbelievable, you know, like he was great. I mean, he was struck him out. I'm like, holy crap, I just struck out Kenny Lofton. But not in spring training, like in an actual big league game. Like this is when the lights are on, man. It's not about spring training now. So I then getting put in the rotation, dealing with blisters, crazy amount of blisters. that I couldn't stay in the rotation, going to Dominican, pitching in Dominican, to getting blisters down there, to coming back, to having my nail removed, to trying to start again, figuring it out, finally figuring it out, going 7-8 innings against the Yankees in Boston, and like, okay, I got, then they're like, ah, we lost a closer. Can you close? Got moved to the closing role. Then they took me to arbitration as a lefty specialist. I'm like, lefty specialist? Like, just crazy, crazy stuff to sabotage. Like, it put a bitter taste in my mouth. You know, and the Glass family, you know, granted, they bought a baseball team. They provided for us, so I can't disrespect them too much. But the way they treated me in arbitration, and they had to, they just tried to be cheap all the way around, cut or cut me. It was so bad. I literally didn't, I hated the game. I was like, this is a joke. Like, it's political. They're not for you. Your own team isn't even for you. Like, they're losing on purpose because they want to get draft picks. They don't even want, you know, they want to get the revenue sharing on top of it. So you're like, this is stupid. I don't want to play this game. I got no shot at winning, you know? So I got, it became this super exciting kid that just made a big league team at 22 to not even enjoying the process of being in the big leagues within 3-4 years, man. It was really sad, to be honest with you.
That time too, kind of like going back to what I asked when you were in Double A, after you've seen the lay of the land and what you could be, after you're in the big leagues for a couple of years, you're shuttling between these roles, you're starting, you're closing, you're doing all this stuff. Did you have an idea? Were you able to even hone an idea of, this is what I think I should be in the big, I should be this guy, or I should have this kind of career? Was, and was that what you ended up with at the Giants, or were you still like, man, I should be a starter. I know I have the stuff. Like, what did you want for yourself?
You know, I think if they would have left me as a starter and let me just be a starter, fail. I mean, like, just, it's the Royals. What are you going to do? Win? Honestly, and that's not a knock. That's just like, it's true. Like, What is it going to kill you for me to lose and learn how to be a big league starter that could potentially help you in a high level situation as a starter? And they made me a number two. I lost opening day in 2003, I think it was. I lost opening day starter to a coin flip to Ronaldo Hernandez. It was legitimately a coin flip. We had to call it. I called, and the guys were so mad at me. They're like, bro, tails never fails, bro. You called heads?
That is true. Tails, yeah, no, that is kind of,
they were
on
like,
you.
You're an idiot. I'm like, ah, dang it. You know, but you lose opening day start on that. I'm sorry, but teams that win do not do coin flips for opening day, right? They just don't. Like, so the mentality wasn't there, but I was doing well, and they took me out of it. You know, like, I was starting to figure it out. And I feel like if they would have left me there, you know, would I have done well? I think so. But I can't guarantee it, because I can tell you that I enjoyed being a reliever a lot more than I enjoyed being a starter, because I did not like sitting around preparing for my start all day. You're just sitting there, You know, some guys go to movies, some guys, I just didn't want to know when I was pitching. So if I could have taken my relief mentality to the start, where it's like, I'm not going to think about pitching until I get to the field. I don't really care. You know, I do a lot better. But When I became a reliever, and when I became a full-time reliever with the Rockies, I actually started to enjoy the game. I loved the coming in a big-time situation. I loved like not knowing, warming up, sitting down, getting going, coming in and just letting it fly. Like, something about that high-level, high-pressure situation, I got calmer. Whereas a starter, I felt like I just never ginned up for the game, or I was mentally spent before the game started, over preparing, right? So could I have done it? I think so. But would my journey have taken me to the Rockies as if I was a starter? No, because they didn't need a starter. Going to the World Series at the Rockies because I was a reliever. Would I have gone to the Giants? No. What am I going to break into the Kane, Lincecum rotation? Like, you're not getting in there, you know. Bumgarner, like
Jonathan Sanchez, just
they had their dudes, guys, man. Like, so would I have gone to them? No, they needed a setup man. So my journey in that area allowed me to take this path to get to these teams, which brought 3 world championships. Like, so could I have done it? Maybe. But I might have been with the Royals and the Angels and the freaking White Sox and never won a World Series. You know what I'm saying? Like, you just would have bounced around rather than been in a situation where they needed a big time lefty to basically come in and be a big guy throwing hard from the left side with a breaking ball and just throw for an inning. Great. Great. And for me, I thoroughly enjoyed it, and my brain's quirky and I love messing around. I don't like over focusing. And so for me, man, I probably say the route that I took, would I have appreciated a different scenario in the sense how they took it? Maybe, but I'm not going to ever say I wish it would have been any different, because I think it worked out pretty good for me.
It did. It did. So you mentioned that. You mentioned that move to Colorado. You're traded at the deadline. Fresh start. Defined role. The year after you get there, it's a World Series team. It is also pitching in Colorado. Anytime I get someone who pitches in Colorado, I mean, when you hear you're going to play half your games in Colorado, what's the adjustment? Do you change a lot of the things you do when you're pitching in Colorado, or is it I have to pitch my game and, you know, the thin air be damned?
No, you got to change. I didn't realize it at first when I got traded there. I remember just like thinking, oh my gosh, I was so excited to get traded. I just went to the airport right away. I mean, I literally was on a plane within 2 hours. I was at the game that night when I got traded, and I was in Kansas City. I still got to the game that night and suited up and sat in the bullpen. I wanted out of there, but I'll tell you what, I didn't probably understand. I knew when I landed, I was like, oh, I just got traded to the freaking moon. This is gonna be, I'm already hating the game of baseball. Now there's no gravity. Great. You know? And I remember I was kind of pouting a little bit, but I remember getting into the second game, and I was facing Prince Fielder, and I was like, I face this guy in interleague. He can't hit a curveball to save his life. So I was like, all right. So I get up there, and my first pitch was a curveball, and it didn't break because it's Colorado. And I'm like, I threw it like I do in Kansas City. I just threw it up there, and I was like, oh, dear. And he hit that thing in the second deck. I was like, first impression, curveball, homer. I'm like, well, that's going to go over well. And then all, like, there's no one in the stands, so all you heard was like, welcome to Colorado. And you're like, oh, man, this blows. And I just remember thinking – all right. So I had kind of an up and down. I had a couple blow up outings, did well, blow up outing. So your numbers are terrible. They're like a six. And I didn't think I'd get it. I thought they'd just let me go. You know, I was an arbitration guy again. It was my last year of arbitration. I'm like, they're not going to pay me, you know? And they did. They picked up arbitration and they paid me. And they said, listen, you're a left-handed pitcher. You're a left-handed reliever. That's who you are. Don't change anything. I want you to work. Figure out a way to become the best left-handed reliever you can possibly become. And I was like, all right. And so I remember calling Mike Mason again. And I remember saying, hey, Mike, I got picked up by the Rockies again, but I got to have a year. Like, I got to fix something. Something's not right. I'm not enjoying it, and my stuff's off. And you're the only guy I trust. And he worked for the Royals. And he's like, all right, fly into Minneapolis, and I'm going to work with you for 10 days. So I flew in. It was minus 30 with the wind chill. I mean, it was – and I remember we I would be – I my and my uncle lived in Minneapolis, so I would live with him. I'd drive in, run as fast as I could to the gym, and my clothes would already be iced over. I mean, it was crazy. I went snowmobiling, and my mask broke in half because of how cold it was, right? Like, it was freezing. And I worked for 10 days when he put me on video. He said, we're going to lower your arm slot. You're up here. I want you down here. Like, I'm going to lower that sucker, and we're going to work on a different delivery. And I said, all right. He goes, you'll still be in a power position, but I want you to cover more of the plate with your breaking ball. And I said, all right. And we did that. We worked for 10 days. And I worked hard for those 10 days revamping
stuff.
That's
a lot of blind trust. That's a big change in something that you've been – from something that got you to the big leagues and you've been doing for 10 plus years.
That's right. Yep. And he just said, hey, man, but I was so all in that I was like, hey, what I'm doing right now is not working. So he's like, all right, we need to get these umpires to see your curveball as a strike more often. We need the hitters to see that curveball as a strike more often, even if it's not, to get them to want to commit. And we got to keep that fastball at the knees, man. We got to keep it right there because we're going to break off that breaking ball. And I remember that year, 07, my ERA in Colorado was 0.9. It was crazy. And I was like, what? But then my ERA on the road was like a 5. So I'm like, I can't, dude, I could have had a crazy number if I would have had a, like it was like, dang it, And but we still went to the World Series. I pitched in every game of the World Series, had a great World Series, signed with Cincinnati and come in with that same slot. And I remember they're like, I was still getting hit a little bit, but I remember Todd Helton was like, dude, I remember seeing him when I was in Cincinnati. He's like, honestly, man, you throw 100 miles an hour. You're the hardest throwing hittable pitcher I've ever seen. He's like, what are you doing? I'm like, I don't know. He's like, man, you're my ex-teammate, but we had the same agent, right? He's like, but dude, you're like a brother. You got to fix something, man, because you can't throw that hard and get hit. We see you. We can see the pit. Like, you're hittable, man. And we don't can't he's like, I can't guarantee you why you're hittable. I can just see you. Like, it's right there. It's not like 100 for us. I was throwing 98. He's like, it's not 98. It doesn't seem like it. And so I remember David Weathers walking up to me, and I was after Helton. He said, you know why that is? I'm like, why is it? Because you throw a four seamer up here and you're trying to throw it down here and your curveball's popping up there. That's why they can see it. They know what pitch is coming out of your hand. He's like, you got to throw a sinker. You're going to can that four seamer. We're going to throw a sinker and throw your breaking ball off your sinker. And I'm like, and he was stormy with me. He was a crazy sinker guy, right? With a great slider. And he said, I'm going to teach you my sinker. And I want you to throw it 80% of the time. And when you get into the game, throw it 80% speed. Just throw it 80%. Don't overthrow it. Just BP fastball. I don't care if they freak out because your velocity went from 98 to 90 and you're not hurt, we're working on something. And if they have something to say about it, I'll tell them. So I'm like, all right. So we work it. Man, I remember the first guy I faced was Lance Berkman, and he's seen me a lot. And I throw him this sinker. And I back off, throw him a sinker, and he kind of swings and he kind of chunks it right into the ground, hits a ground ball to second base to get out of the inning. And I'm walking across the line and look at him. He's like, you have a sinker? And I'm like, yes, so. He's like, I'm like, it's kind of new. He's like, well, it's not in the scouting report. I'm like, it's like good. And so I remember I face him again, throw all curveballs at him. So curveball, 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 sinker. And he finally is like, dude, he's shaking his head. And then I started throwing sinker and sinker. And then I started getting comfortable with the grip. My velocity went from 90, 93, 94, 95, 96. I'm throwing 96 mile an hour sinkers. Had an incredible through 74 ball games for Dusty that year. Had like I think a low 3 or something in Cincinnati. And that's pretty much
That's
Colorado.
also hitters ballpark.
Yeah, so
Were
like,
you living arm side with that sinker, or would you get to a point where you just throw it all over the place?
nah, I lived arm side. I threw it right down the middle and let it run because I didn't know where it was going and I couldn't control the movement. So I try to turn it over, and so I couldn't throw it. I try to throw hip shots, but then I'd push it, right? So it would work because it would move guys, but it wasn't coming back. And so I just tried to throw it right down the middle and let it run. And I just got nut. I had an unbelievable second half. I mean, it was crazy my second half. And that's when Giants called me and gave me the deal I wanted. And for the rest of my career, I was a sinker curveball and got 32 double plays or something like that, or 25 double plays my year in 09. Like, I was a double play machine. I'd walk the guy to get the double play, but is what it is. I'm trying to figure out command of my sinker, because I'd walk everybody and then I get a double play the next pitch. But I mean, that year in 09, I was throwing 90. 596 mile an hour sinkers, 83 mile an hour curveballs wherever I want. I mean, I was out of my mind. And I mean, I tried to replicate that year. I couldn't even do it. And when I'd struggle, I'd go back to those videos of when I pitched and I'm like, why can't I do that? I mean, I was 09 year was just a crazy year.
Well, you still were able to find success throughout the rest of your career. So let's get to San Francisco, the city where a lot of things happen for you.
Yeah.
Is there a magic bullet that World Series teams have that others don't? Because you've been on four teams that reached the World Series, three that won the World Series. Like, is there a secret sauce?
Pitching. It is it. It is it. And people do not get it. They don't. They still don't. And Texas did. When Bochy went to Texas, I'll guarantee he walked in and said, I need pitching. I got the lineup. Great, we can hit. Great, we can play pretty good defense. I got to have guys that can throw strikes from inning one to inning nine. I need all starters, bullpens, all to throw strikes. Bochy came in when I got signed in 09. Sabian looked at me and he said, hey, I'm signing you because Bochy needs strike throw. And my walks were up in Cincinnati, but they knew Dusty loved intentional walks. He'd bring me into the game and have me intentionally walk the first guy. And I was like, have the guy that was on the mound intentionally walked it. Why do I got to put my guy on? Like, you know, he loved intentional walks. So they knew that it was up for that. And they said, listen, they need you to pump that strike zone and just stay ahead of the count and let him play defense. Like, strike him out if you have to, but just throw strikes. We got guys walking everybody. So Boach goes, I guarantee you win in Texas, said the same thing. Get me a group of guys that throw strikes and I'll win. And he did, right? He knows pitching. Pitching is it. Colorado, Francis. We had Jeff Francis throwing strikes. Cook that was throwing 79 pitch complete games with a sinker. You know, you had Josh Fogg that was just a strike throwing. He was with me in Cincinnati too. He's just a strike throwing machine. He wasn't anything crazy special, but just threw a ton of strikes, right? I mean, Jimenez was the one that was the wild card. He's throwing 102 miles an hour or whatever, but didn't matter. He was just different. It was okay to have somebody different, right? So we just had guys that threw a lot of strikes. So you get over to San Francisco now, and you have a bullpen that wasn't throwing strikes. They weren't. They had a bunch of young guys that could not maintain close ball games. Well, you brought in Bob Howry. You brought in myself to pitch with Brian Wilson. And the next thing you know, you got Romo. Romo's up and coming. He's throwing filth nasty sliders, right?
Frisbee sliders.
Yeah. So, like, you have that coming in, and you're like, Mota. They went and got Mota, you know, in 10, I think. But it was like they just went and got a bunch of strike throwers to match up with Kane, Lincecum. Vogelsong came in, I think, in was it 09? No, he didn't come in. Zito was there, but I think something happened. I can't remember. It was 2010 that Bogey, I think, stepped in. But you had strike throw after strike throw. And Johnny Sanchez, he didn't throw a lot of strikes. He was just so filthy, like throwing no hitters.
No one could touch that guy.
Yeah, you just couldn't. If he would have thrown more strikes, he would have been even way better, right? So you have all that coming at you, and we're a 2-1 ball game. And you just put in, you know, Howry or myself or Romo or Wheez and just let it go. And that's how we won kind of in 09 to peak it. But then you get 10, add Mota, strike throwing machine, right? Just strike throw after strike and great changeup, you know, and little slider. You got Mota, you got Romo, you got Wilson, myself, and you just got all these. And it's just like, that's all we did was just throw crazy strikes. Oh, Javi. And then you bring in Javi, who's a strike thrower machine
from
too.
His hip.
Yeah, like making people look stupid, right? So, like, you bring all those guys in compared. Now Vogie gets added to the mix, strike throwing machine, understands quadrants, starts throwing all bad bum, freak of nature at 19 years old or whatever he is when he comes up. Like, you add that with the formula is pitching. It's pitching, and people do not understand. And you got to have a bullpen that can have big balls and handle the back end of the rotation when games matter, not when you're up 10-0, not when you're up 6-4 or 6-3, no, 2-1. Like, one pitch changes the course of the game. 1-1 ball games. I need guys that can pitch in a tie ball game or in a 1-run ball game. You get me those in the back end of the pen and give me some starters, we'll win the World Series. It will happen. It will. And to me, these analytic guys, they don't get it. They don't understand the situation.
When you carried a 0.86 ERA in career in the postseason, went scoreless in 2014 and most of 2012. I just the question, because I'm sure you have talked about the World Series and the postseason on there. All that is out there, but I'm just curious, looking at those World Series opponents, Texas has Josh Hamilton, Detroit has Prince, KC had Hosmer, Moustakas, Alex Gordon. That team is very left-handed.
Yeah.
When you're heading into the series, are you just like sequencing those guys in your sleep? Like, is that the focus of knowing that I'm going to have to go get Josh Hamilton in a big spot? I'm going to have to go get, you know, Prince in a big spot and things like
yep.
is is, you know, what are you thinking? Like, how do you pre-game plan, I guess, for the hitters like that, knowing that those big moments are coming?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, for me, I knew I was going to handle the big lefties and the power switch hitters, right? That was your deal. That was my skit. And we'd walk a guy or pitch around a guy if I had to, if I had two outs and we had a switch hitter or a righty coming off the bench. Because Boach's thing was like, if I can get a big-time lefty out of the game and have a righty coming off cold off the bench, I'll let you – my numbers are pretty good. You know, I'm a power guy, right? So, in my sinker away to those righties, it's off the end of the bat, right? So, he was like – but he was just like, I'm going to need that. But if it's a bunch of righties, you're getting Romo's Frisbees. I mean, that's just what you're going to get, right? So he wanted me facing the lefties in the middle of the lineup and some switch hitters in the middle of the lineup and then any cold hitter coming off the bench. That was his biggest deal with me. And so I looked at all those guys, looked at the lineup and said, okay, these are the probably big areas. That's who I'm going to focus on. These are the guys that I know I'm going to face. These are the guys that I could potentially face. I don't care about anybody else. And that helped me a lot. Coming in. And then with Kansas City, it was like, Jeremy, you're going to pitch every game because that's all I got. You know, so they got switchies and the lefties, right? So, you know, for me, I just focused. I kept that really – every series I just kept simple. I really did. I mean, people say, what did you do different? I didn't do anything different. I threw a ton of strikes, and I kept calm, and I didn't allow the situation to be a distraction. I got rid of all my distractions. I don't care if it's the NLCS, NLDS, World Series, Game 1, Game 7. It's 60 feet, 6 inches, and I want to throw strikes, and I want to do my job. I didn't allow anything else to creep into my head. If I would have, I wouldn't have done as well. If I would have thought Kansas City, Game 7, it's Game 7. If I'm thinking Game 7 the whole time out there, I'd probably give it up two bombs, right? So I just thought about execution. I thought about getting that ball. I got to get to the fifth to give Bum the ball. And if I got to blow out doing it, I'm going to blow out doing it. And that was the game plan in Game 7. Figure out a way to get it to the fifth. And I knew I was going to have to pitch and throw more pitches than I've thrown in who knows how many years in one outing. And I just went after it. It probably costed me my 2015 year because I just couldn't bounce back. You know, my arm was just tired and it was just not right ready. But I had to throw the amount of innings I had to throw in 2014 to help pick up some innings and some spots to help other guys get set up for their roles to win that world championship. And that's what it's all about. That's what I'm playing this game for. Like, I'm not playing to play 20 years. Like, I want to ring. And if I'm in the World Series, I don't want to go home. I've been a loser. I've been in Colorado. It sucks. I would rather have not gone to the World Series than losing the World Series. It's tough to lose in the World Series, man. Like, I'm not out there to lose. And so for me, you know, going out there, I just didn't change my approach and didn't let the distractions get to me. And I think, you know, when you get to the playoffs, I think that's what affects a lot of guys is the distraction of the platform they're on at the time. And I just didn't allow that in.
So, yeah, I was going to say that I'm sure the ring makes hurt arm or arm not bouncing back feel a lot better. But you pick up absolutely. Those three rings with the Giants, hang it up. When did you fall in love with craft beer? Why are you sitting where you're sitting right now at your brewery in Burney, Texas?
Fell in love with craft beer in San Francisco. You know, I didn't have a drip of alcohol until I was 26 years old. My first drink was a beer in New Zealand. Man, it was just like, I was like, I'll try one. Why not? When in Rome. All right. Everybody else is drinking it. It's like Germany. Like, they all drink beer. It's like they're water over there, right? So for me, it was like, I didn't even, in fact, Todd Hilton, I talked to him a year ago and he's like, what are you doing? I said, I'm running my brewery. He starts laughing. I'm like, why are you laughing? He's like, dude, you don't even drink. I said, well, I didn't drink when I played with you and I don't drink a lot now. I just like the idea of craft beer. And he's like, this is seriously the funniest and stupidest thing I've ever heard. He just could not buy into the fact that I had a brewery. And so, you know, but I kind of fell in love in San Francisco because I don't like, I would say I didn't love beer. I loved craft beer. Like, I don't like beer. Like, I'm not going to, I mean, you know, I'm not going to drink Coors Light. If I'm going to drink a beer, that's not what I'm drinking. And if I have a choice between water and Coors Light, I'm going to drink water. Like, I don't like that beer. So it's
kind of
like,
the
I'm
same
not gonna...
thing, except one has booze in it.
Yeah, exactly. They're both water, you know? So, and I'm like, but now craft beer was a little different because when I was hanging out 21st Amendment, well, for my fundraisers, I did fundraisers at the brewery there just up from the stadium. I actually got to brew a beer with my brewer now. He worked for 21st in I brewed a beer at Jaren, and he was teaching me, no, we're gonna have a little bit of this. Dude, we could throw a little of this in there. And the most killer thing I ever did with him, we were able to get untreated maple bats from Louisville, and they were not treated, so they didn't have any. He dropped them in the fermenter the entire time, and it pulled the
So
maple.
just a batch just rolling around in the fermenter.
Yeah, he had three bats in there just sitting there, so, and it pulled it out, and it was like, what the? He's like, yeah, but it's cool because baseball, like, you have bats in there, man. And then we pulled those bats out, and I signed them and put them all. Like, it was the coolest thing, man. Like, I was like, wait, you can do that? He's like, you can do whatever you want. You can throw whatever you want in there. It's just a process. I'm like, so I fell in love with that idea. And then the community aspect. I was a community guy my entire career. I love being a part of community events. I love pouring back into the community, using my
That was
influence with the
something I
community.
didn't get to it in my run sheet, but something you were especially highlighted for in your time in San Francisco was
Yeah.
being involved in that community.
And I loved it, and I still love it. Like, it's a platform. It's great. It's what we're there for, right? Like, you got to want to play baseball more than just go out on a field. That's Groundhog's Day. You got to have a purpose to play the game, not just to play the game. If that's your purpose, you're going to get real bored, and it's not going to be very much fun, right? So for me, I was like, wow, it's community. It's creative. We can do fun stuff. And I just loved making a beer with him. And I remember when I came here, and I didn't know what I wanted to do. I was like, I can't hunt and fish my whole life, right? Can't do that. And I remember I lost my marriage, and it was a kick to the gut, man. It was 20 plus years. I mean, it was a kick to the gut. I'm a family guy. Like, I freaking love family. And so when the boy's mother decided to depart, I was like, oh, I mean, it was just such a devastating moment for me. But I was like, all right, nope, it's baseball. What do you do in baseball? Controllables and uncontrollables. I can't control that. What I can control is how I react with my boys, how I love my boys, and how I push through life. That's all I can control. So what am I going to do? And I remember I was speaking at a brewery. I got brought in to speak at, for this church, and this pastor was like, hey, man, I can't get anybody to come out to my men's nights. And I'm like, oh, yeah? So where do you have them? He's like, at my church. Well, there ain't a man in this country that wants to go to work and then go into a classroom after work. It's just not going to happen. There's no one going to say, can't wait to go there. You know, I was like, you got to have it somewhere else, man. He's like, well, that's kind of why I was like trying to tell you. I just didn't know if I'd offend you. And I'm like, where are we at? He's like, I'm at a brewery. I put it at Jack Russell Brewery. And I'm like, you obviously do not know me. I said, I'll be more than comfortable speaking to men at a brewery. So I get to this brewery, grab a beer, light a cigar, walk up on stage, and everybody's like, they kind of look at me and they all start leaving. And I was like, man, I didn't know I'd offend people with a freaking cigar and a beer. Like, we're at a brewery. Well, they all came back with cigars and cigarettes. And everybody was laughing because they were like, well, I didn't know if it was like appropriate or pastors here. And so I'm like, yeah, let me tell you something.
A real smoke 'em if you got 'em situation.
If you're gonna do it at your house, just do it here. What is your pastor gonna get mad? Like, I was like, he laughed. He's like, yeah, that's the problem. I'm dealing with this kind of a mental situation. They're not seeing it. And so I remember having so much, like, I cried with the, I talked about the Buffalo mentality. I didn't quite lose my marriage yet, but I was about to. I could feel it. So I was like, man, I want to tell him about charging storms, man, and taking it on, and knowing that God has a. And I remember doing all that, right? And I remember I was going down the hill, and I was like, I really like just talking to people at a brewery. Like, I enjoy the community aspect of it. I enjoy the, I love talking to men about men's stuff, man. I love it. I freaking love it. And I was like, I'm gonna do this. I'm gonna start a brewery in Burney, and I'm gonna have a beer garden. I'm gonna do men's nights. I'm gonna have a great time, and I'm gonna brew a good beer. Now I gotta figure out how to convince someone to. I'm not gonna brew, and I knew that where we were at was ripe for a really good brewery, and we have a couple of them here. I just knew there could do be another one, right? I was like, man, we could do this. We could make a brewery like capital area down here. I just want I gotta have the right brewer. And I remember thinking about Jaren, and I remember calling Brandon, who's no longer with us, but he helped us get us going, and saying, I want to do this, and they're like, well, you're gonna need Jaren. I'm like, I don't know if we're gonna get that guy. He's like one of the best brewers in the country. And he's like, we'll get him. And Jaren said, I'm in. I'm ready. And he came out with me. And now I do exactly that. Men's nights, I just had it last night. I get 100, 150 men back there. We light cigars. I got a cigar guy out here. You know, I got food trucks. The community aspect of it's awesome. I'm doing bingo. I'm gonna MC bingo. I'm doing my own bingo night. I can do what I want. I'm like, freaking, we're doing bingo on Wednesdays. So we got that. We're gonna do, we have music. We got trivia, men's nights, women's nights. I mean, we just do so much, and I love it because I can say, I dictate it. This is what we're doing. And people are coming in, some of the intrigue of the athlete, right? There is that, obviously. But there's a part of it, it's like, yeah, but you're thinking I'm gonna come in and just be a face. You're gonna see that I care about the community. Like, I care about every aspect of it. I care about the influence of women, men, children. You know, I care about the, we have a Bible study that's 30 deep in Thursday mornings, and I got people that are 20 to 80 years old in it, because the gray hair, I call them the gray hair, the wisdom, the wise men of our area, I want them here talking to the younger guys. Like, we are all about community, and what better way to do it than over beer? Like, it's awesome. You know, like we all just hang out. You know, we have NA beer, we got NA, we got wine. My wife's a big wine person. We got wine. The women love it. They got good beer. We got sodas for the kids. We do our own root beer. Like, it's awesome for me. You know, I'm looking out my right in front of me is a big, huge window, and I'm looking at my brewery. I'm seeing people just packed in here laughing. They're like, that's it. That's what it's all about, you know? And I get to use my influence on that, and we'll bring in, I've got the ability to bring in certain speakers because of what I did. Get all that. And people all talk baseball, and I got a bat rack in there that has a bat of guys either played with or played against that I appreciate, and I have a story behind every one of them. And people will be like, hey, tell them about that bat. Tell them a story about it, you know? Like, it's great, you know? And for me to have that kind of influence, that's what I did in the game, is use my platform to have an influence in the community. Now I just use it a little differently, but I still get to have influence, and I still get a platform.
Well, your brewery, Free Roam, a couple of the other, spots that you mentioned there, a couple of the other breweries have done what I thought, as someone who grew up in Bernie, was impossible, was make Bernie kind of cool. So that has been that's been a beloved change. But the last thing, really, if you could go back, give a pep talk to your 18-year-old self, fresh off signing that contract with the Royals, what would that pep talk look like?
Man, it would be like, hey, man, you gotta understand the controllable, the uncontrollable that you're about to walk into. It's going to be a highly competitive area. And if you're focusing on your failures and you're focusing on your uncontrollables, man, in a negative way, you're never going to be who you want to be. If you look at baseball as a failure, which is what 90, like 70% of the game is, if you say the word failure, you'll be exactly that. If you say it's a teachable moment, you'll win. And for me, I want you to look, Jeremy, at 18, I want you to look at every failure you have as a teachable moment, learn from every one of those. And when you have success, enjoy it. Enjoy the one good outing. Enjoy a six inning shutout. Enjoy it. Don't be like, whatever, next game. No, enjoy it for a couple days. What did you do right? What did you learn from your failure that allowed you to do that right? Now you go out the next game and you might go five innings, six innings, give up four runs. Okay. What did you learn? I didn't have a quality start. No. What did you learn that you can do the next time out? And then those are the things that are going to go into that bank that is going to allow you to be that guy that goes out and then consistently goes six, seven, eight innings, three runs or less. That's what you're going to be, but you're not going to be that right out the gate. So take every moment that you don't succeed and learn from it and make it a teachable moment, and then trust it and go through the process, because the process is okay. It's okay to go through that process of learning. It's not always about be succeeding. If you succeed too much early, you're never going to learn how to, you're not going to learn how to fail. You're not going to learn how to learn late, right? You're going to give up and you're going to quit. And so you need to take those things as teachable moments, man, and give it your best shot. That's what I tell them.
I got a quick rapid fire for you, then I'll let you get out of here.
Yeah.
Favorite minor league ballpark?
Favorite minor league ballpark, Dell Diamond.
Favorite big league ballpark?
I got a San Francisco. Because I loved it there, but I would say if I didn't have to, if I didn't, let's say non-play, not non-home, St. Louis.
Best hitter you ever faced?
Albert Pujols.
Good choice. Best San Francisco food spot?
Best San Francisco. Oh, dude, there's too many good ones. Ugh, man. Okay, not a lot of people know it, but it's called the Pinecrest. It's right. It's a Pinecrest Cafe. Has the best egg white omelet I've ever had in my entire life, and they're open 24 hours. It's awesome. I go there at 2 a.m.
Last thing I've got, everyone gets this. Do you have a nightmare bus ride story from the minor leagues?
Nightmare bus ride story. Yeah, so many nightmare bus ride stories. Man, a nightmare bus ride story. If I had to close my eyes and think about it. So there was a time. So when you're driving and you got to go, and there's a guy on our team named Corey Hart
Oh yeah,
and
big
little
long
infielder.
time big leaguer Corey Hart, right?
Yeah, no, no,
Different.
no, no, not him, not the outfielder. He's a little infielder with the Royals and good little ball player, but never made it. And he'd always play the song Sunglasses at Night. That was his big deal, Corey Hart song, right? So we were on a bus ride and we had played we were in double A. Those are the long bus rides.
Texas League is the long bus ride league.
Bro, 16 hours, right? So I rem but you had to do what you had to do. And I was on the 40 man, so the 40 man got their own seat, right? That was just the gig, right? You didn't have to team up with anybody. So I was on the 40 man, but the seats still were not comfortable. It wasn't like the buses they have today, right? They're the old school ones where this even the like the break down the middle had like a metal beam in it. So if you tried to lay down, it'd be right in your freaking lower back, right? So remember I was like, dude, I can't do this. I gotta sleep. And I just remember getting on the floor and sleeping and laying down. And I remember waking up just feeling this warm fluid.
Oh no.
And I'm like, what? And I look up and Corey Hart's dip cup that he'd been dipping in for 6 hours had tipped over and it was soaking into my body. It was all over me. Like it rolled down. He was asleep and he dropped it and it was rolling down and I was soaked in it. And what are you gonna do? Stop the bu Dude, I was so hot. I jumped up. I'm like, come on. And then everybody's like laughing. I'm covered in dip and it's spit too. This is not dip. It's like spit dip, right? So, and I remember I was so mad. And he woke up and he's like looking around and he was such a southern boy. He just remember he was like, oh, sorry, Phil. I apologize. And I'm like, apologize? I'm soaked in spit. He's like, yeah. That was mine. And then he put another freaking piece of dip in his mouth and he kept going. And I never slept. I mean, never again. Like that is so grotesque to me. Like, and it's, I woke up 'cause it was soaking my neck. It was just all over me. And it was just like, oh, so that was a rough go, man. I was, ugh, that kind of stuff. But that happened a lot. Honestly, it did. I saw it happen a lot more than just to me. Just when it happened to me, it was, oof.
Guy, almost 100 episodes in, and I do think that is our first dip spit story. So we'll add that.
It
We'll
was
add that one to
terrible.
the wall. Jeremy, that is all I've got for you. Very grateful for your time. Thank you so much for joining from Phenom of the Farm.
Heck yeah, man. Thanks for having me.
You got it. And that's it for today's episode of From Phenom to the Farm. Huge thanks to Jeremy Affeld for stopping by, walking us through his journey in baseball. If you enjoyed this episode, please remember to subscribe wherever you get your podcast. Rate and leave a review if you're on Apple Podcasts. Tell a friend if that friend likes baseball. And make sure to subscribe to Baseball America for all your amateur baseball and prospect news. And with that, we'll catch you in 2 weeks. Thanks for listening.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.